Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Addisk. I'm here on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. My co-host today is Roger Sales, calling in from Argentina. Roger will be on here. I will be with us in a moment. Before he comes on, let's have the morning or the afternoon market report. Gold is up a dollar to $1,576.60. Silver's up 16 cents to $28.80 an ounce. Platinum is up 19 to $1,593 per ounce. Palladium's up 20 to $741 per ounce. Dow Jones is up 126 points to 14,254. This is, I assume we're in record territory right now. NASDAQ is up $42.10 to 3,224. New York Stock Exchange is up 87 points to 8,988. It appears that New York Stock Exchange is close to breaking 9,000. We'll see. I won't imagine that happens today, but maybe this week we could go over 9,000 in the New York Stock Exchange. U.S. dollar is down 10 cents or 0.10 to 82.09. Crude oil up 75 cents to $90.87 per barrel. You know, one of the things that may be helpful in order to understand what's happening in the economy is consider the following hypothesis. The government is working to hold the price of gold down, and it's also working to hold the stock market indicators up. So what we have is a certain amount of a teeter-totter effect, where we have, on the one side of the teeter-totter, we have stock prices which are being artificially supported, and on the other end of the teeter-totter, we have gold prices, which are being artificially suppressed. And the net result is the stock market is up on one end of the teeter-totter, and the gold is down on the other end of the teeter-totter, and governments and central banks are working to maintain, to defy gravity. All right? The stock markets should probably be down significantly. The price of gold should probably be up significantly, meaning that the teeter-totter, in our analogy, instead of stocks up and gold down, we should have gold up and stocks down. Maybe. If it's true that the government is fighting the force, figuratively speaking, fighting the force of gravity, but trying to hold stocks up, hold gold down, how long do you suppose they can continue to maintain this unnatural imbalance on the teeter-totter? Our guest is Roger Sales, author of From Sovereign to Serfs. Roger, are you there?
I'm right here, Al, and happy to be here with you in the audience again today on a nice Tuesday. Beautiful, beautiful, picturesque fall day here.
Well, what do you think about Bluebird. This teeter-totter?
Well, I think there's a bunch of teeter-tottering going on, man.
I understand.
To answer your question, as a bunch of the audience, no doubt, is your kind of rhetorical question there, is that these guys, many people, including myself, wouldn't have thought they could have held this out 10 years ago.
I agree. You got to give the devil its due. They have been able to defy reality and defy the force of economic gravity, and assuming that the analogy is correct, they've been able to defy it for a considerable period of time, far longer than I would have thought. And it makes you wonder, how long do you think they can hold it together?
I remember hearing, talking to people back in the Atlanta days, you know, when we had those big groups going on every week, and one guy said that he had a whole bunch of silver back in the 70s, thinking that they couldn't, you know, hold it through the run-up at gold there at 79 and 80. Yeah. So it's a heck of a time to be alive. You know, Al, I shot you, and people can go over to King World.
I ducked, so you missed. You didn't hit me because I ducked, but go ahead.
Well, okay. Well, that's good. That's what I would have expected from you. Is the interview on King World News, an audio interview with Jim Sinclair. Jim Sinclair's a pretty sharp cookie. He's one of those sharp knives in the drawer that you hear people talking about. And for the people that may not have heard about this, you know, his father was Jesse Livermore's partner back in the 20s.
What's the significance of Jesse Livermore?
Well, you know,
that's okay.
A little background. Jesse Livermore is considered to be one of the best investors in all time on Wall Street, and he did it strictly by the seat of his pants. And I was explaining this to one of the people I communicate with regularly on email the other day, and he wasn't familiar with Livermore, so I went back and start-paged. We don't use the G word anymore. I start-paged Jesse Livermore up and started reading about him. I knew who he was, but I didn't know his background, and it's really fascinating. He left home at 14 with his mother's blessings. He was from up in Massachusetts, Connecticut somewhere in the Northeast, and he left home at 14 with his mother's blessings against his father's will because his father wanted to put him to work on the farm. And he went into Boston and got into stock trading and that stuff early on just by instinct, and that was his whole career. And he lost fortunes three or four times up to, in that day, in the 20s, $100 million. So you can equate that to billions of dollars today. Yeah. And he was Jim Sinclair's father's partner. And Jim Sinclair knew him when he was growing up. He was still in his life and taught him some of these instincts and some of his philosophies and what he did. And that, if you want to go to King World News and go over, I think that was a Saturday interview with Jim Sinclair. It's about, 30 minutes long. And the reason I wanted to bring that up in the background, although interesting, it was necessary, was to say that Sinclair sees gold going to between four and five thousand an ounce sometime soon. And what he said is that if you're a trader and you haven't had the stomach for what's gone on in the last couple of weeks where it was barely down 10%, that you're going to see some gigantic ups and downs between the $4,000 and $5,000 range, trading range.
He actually spoke in terms of the possibility of $1,000 fall in the price of gold after it approaches, he implied, after it approaches the $5,000 level in one day. Not $1,000 spread out over 6 months or a year. He thinks the possibility. So what he's implying that he thinks, he didn't say this, but he implies at least that he thinks the maximum price of gold might be somewhere in the neighborhood of $3,500, $4,000 per ounce. Do you agree with that? You know, that's my interpretation. Do you think my interpretation is halfway valid, or do you read it a different way?
I think that there's nobody on the face of the earth knows how high that metal's going to go.
Yeah, I agree with that. But do you think that, well, again, I'm reading Sinclair's comments to imply that he thinks that when we get in the $4,000-$5,000 range, it will become extraordinarily volatile, and he's suggesting that the price could fall as much as $1,000 in a single day when we get to that point. And
yes,
he's saying,
exactly.
You people better buckle up. Better buckle up, and you better be ready to deal with this emotionally. Because
you know,
it's shocking.
What brought this up in this correspondence in the email with the guys, he asked some question, I don't remember what he asked, and I responded back with Jesse Livermore's famous statement, which is one that I've taken to heart after I heard it, because I thought it made so much sense. And he said, you know, people ask him the way of his success, and he said, buy right, sit tight.
Yeah. Meaning what?
Meaning buy low and sell high.
Well, that's part of it. But the other thing is this. When he says sit tight, he's saying don't speculate in terms of buying something today in anticipation of selling it tomorrow or next week or even next month.
Well,
make it your business to buy a solid, sensible investment today in anticipation of holding it, sitting tight for some considerable period of time. He's saying invest, don't speculate.
It was interesting, and Sinclair was drawing some parallels to the people that were in the market back in the 20s in those days, and that they were true traders, and he was drawing the point that they really were mercantilists, okay?
Yep.
That they had a sense of supply and demand and the market, all right? So when you say that sit, buy right, sit tight, you're saying, he's saying, know your poop well enough to understand the fundamentals and know what's the buy that's got the inevitability high side, and that's where you plant your flag.
That's now, exactly right.
Yeah, I took, because I studied all this stuff through the 90s so heavily, because I knew it was critical to unraveling the puzzle, and I have a personal interest in it. I think everybody's interested in their own well-being. I mean, come on. That's the reason we used to use the tax issue to try and wake people up, because everybody's concerned about your darn pocketbook and these thieves, okay? So if you internalize those basics and you start learning a little bit reading about Austrian economics and you start understanding supply and demand and what's happened in the fiat monetary system and you start putting that all together back then in Brown's Bottom, that they affectionately call it, and I call it that too because I was bellying up to Brown's Bottom, okay, at 250.
I don't know what you mean by Brown's Bottom.
That's
I don't understand
when
what you
gold mean. That's when gold hit the lowest point in 2001, and Gordon Brown sold half of England's gold supply at $251 an ounce.
Yeah.
And they call it Brown's Bottom. Now, nobody asked the question, Al. The correct question, everybody's going, what did he do it for? The question is, who the heck did he sell it to?
Yeah. How much did he get for himself?
See, there's a lot of speculation that this was in the early days, and they were trying to cover the London Bullion Market Exchange's rear end with that gold.
Yeah.
On all of this gold scam, see? Because if you think back, we talked about it last week, back in the early part of the last decade, is when Chapman was making those remarks that his contacts at the LBMA, the London Bullion Market Exchange, whatever it is, over there, the London Bullion Exchange, were having and reporting that the U.S. was delivering melt bars, not pure gold bars, but melt bars, and those could only come from the seizure of the St. Gaudens and the gold on March the 9th, 1933, that was remelted down and not re-smelted to take the impurities out. Because there's alloys in those coins to help make them hard.
Which means, among other things, that gold that we believe to be in the custody of the United States has actually been sold long ago to support the London Bullion Market Association. That's one of the implications. Is that true or false? Do you think that's true or false?
And the, I think it's absolutely true. And, you know, I saw a headline on a site the other day that said LIBOR is the biggest financial scandal in history. I said, well, you wait till this comics thing, Mars, baby. Okay? You're going to rewrite that headline, okay?
Yeah, I know. LIBOR, the biggest financial headline to date. But stick around.
You got to qualify these headlines these days.
Yeah, exactly. Huh? So far, the biggest financial scandal so far. Stick around. The ones you hear, if you hear about that, it almost absolutely and necessarily follows that there's a bigger scandal buried back there someplace and maybe several bigger ones.
Hey, listen, we're in for some revelations over the next couple of years, and let me drop back to Sinclair here. I don't think he was putting a $5,000 top on gold. I think
he kind of sounded like it. He didn't say that. That's absolutely true, but he implied.
You know, his orientation is trading. Didn't he say in that interview at one point he oversaw 35 technical commodities markets or something at one point of his career?
And I don't remember that remark per se, but go ahead.
He's got the mind of a trader, so he's looking at this, and he's having a conversation with King there on I think, a trading perspective, and he's saying, when you get in this range, if you're a trader between 4 and 5, buckle up, buddy, okay, because you're going to see some real bumpy roads. He didn't say that it was restricted to 5. Listen, they keep putting money. They're going to peg this puppy at, okay?
Eventually. It may be that he just anticipates that at that point there will be some resistance and the market will be extremely volatile until it reestablishes itself, say at 4,000.
Yeah, think about
Might go sideways for a year or so and then start going up again to 10,000 or wherever.
Exactly like it's done over the last year or so. But can you imagine, start looking at the vistas above 5,000 an ounce and start, you know, thinking in terms of 10 plus, you can see why the guys that are fighting so hard to keep it below 16 at that level would bring out the base. I mean, they probably got the baseball bats out anyway. There's no telling what they'll bring out at 5,000.
Yeah, I understand.
So he hadn't, you know, chased them and run them all back there to Satan's sandbox by then.
All right, well, whatever is going to happen with gold, one of the things that does cross my mind about Jim Sinclair, I know from the interview, he's been in the markets for 50 years. And it implies that he has come to assume a position very similar to that of Bob Chapman.
Oh, yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and it may be that he's going to kind of, he may come to, you know, occupy a similar position before this is all over. He's certainly close to it.
Well, he does a certain segment, I'm sure, already. You know, in that reading about Jesse Livermore, though, Al, I came upon something. You know, you've had a question in your mind about something, and down the line you read something, it just comes together. In reading about Jesse Livermore, it was talking about how some of his successes in the 20s were involved with what they call bucket shops. Have you ever heard that term?
No, I don't think I have.
They blamed the crash in 29 on these bucket shops, and in an article I had seen several years ago, there was a corollary there, and the guy brought the correlation between bucket shops and derivatives. And I didn't understand it back then, but I remembered the comparison. And in reading about Livermore, there was an explanation of bucket shops in there. And what they were in the 20s, they would have businesses that were not affiliated with the stock market that would come in and take private bets on what stocks were going to do in the stock markets. And they were huge pools of slush money that could affect the markets dramatically.
That was before we had the NFL and the NBA then.
Right. And so if you think about it with derivatives, and that whoever made the comment in whatever article was correct, in that context, derivatives are what are derivatives? There is a contract that's based on something that's derived. Okay, so it's apart from, and it's these huge pools of slush money, and it's exactly the same thing. Nothing new under the sun, my friend.
I understand. There's only so many. There are only so many moves on the board. Once you really get an idea of how many squares there are on the board, how many moves there are, it becomes more predictable. One of the things that's predictable, Roger, is that we're going to break to take a 3-minute commercial. When we come back, we're going to take a call from George in Detroit. I'm Alfred Addis here with Roger Sales on Financial Survival. We'll be right back.
PSA count high? Half of all men over 50 have an enlarged prostate. You can shrink your prostate without harmful drugs or risky surgery. The secret to healing the prostate is to cleanse the prostate and the liver. Call Apothecary Herbs to ask about the Prostate Kit for a comprehensive way to heal and soothe your prostate. Educate yourself on how easy it can be to disinfect, cleanse, and restore your prostate gland. Call Apothecary Herbs for the Prostate Kit and successfully reduce swelling, inflammation, dissolve stones, and cleanse the blood to obtain the results you need. Money-back guarantee with every purchase. Call the experts in organ cleansing. Call Apothecary Herbs now for the Prostate Kit and empower yourself. Toll free 866-229-3663 for international callers 704-875-8010. That's toll free 866-229-3663 or visit the web at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Roger Sales on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver. 1-800-375-4188. For all your gold and silver coin needs, give Melody Cederstrom a call. She's there now. Should be. 1-800-375-4188. George called in early on the program, and we're just now getting around to taking his call. George, are you there?
Yes, thank you. What I'm about to ask, you've gone over before in the past. Last week, where I live, I was delivered a census survey addressed to a resident. And while I'm trying to have nothing to do with this system of the screw-up and screwed-up, corrupt and degenerate, evil criminal government, can you go over the definition of resident and also the definition of what status I should be in?
Wow.
All right, George, thank you for your question. I don't know if you want to hang on or not, but Roger will begin to address that question.
George, you threw me a big softball. Thanks. It's we're going over these basics over on the other show tomorrow morning in the last couple of weeks, and we'll be talking about this tomorrow. So, actually, I've been thinking about it. George, you're up there in Detroit. Is he still with us, Al? Are you up there in Detroit?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, man.
City of Michigan.
Well, listen, the resident, you can go to the Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, and you don't have to go to a law dictionary, and you'll see the first definition in Webster's Collegiate Dictionary is the act or fact of dwelling or living in a place for some time. Now, that is what I call the geographical definition. In Webster's, definition number two is the act or fact of living or dwelling in a place for some time, the exact same sentence, for the receipt of a benefit or the discharge of a duty. There's the legal definition.
All right.
Now, benefits and duties, and you come back to what is jurisdiction. Jurisdiction is allegiance. It comes from the feudal era, from the lords that gave you protection, and if they gave you protection and you were their property, you owed them your allegiance, and that is the basic concept of jurisdiction, okay? And so in this resident word, if you go to Words and Phrases in the Law Library, which is a set of books that pulls words and phrases that are key out of different court cases, references them back to the case, and it groups them all together. And you can go look under resident in Words and Phrases, and one of the entries in there from some case, and I don't remember the style of the case, it says, whenever the term resident is used in any kind of a legal setting, its definition is always legal. Didn't say sometimes, okay? So the other part of this that may help people understand this a little bit better is residency. The concept comes from countries trading ambassadors. And when the ambassadors from a foreign country are in D.C. and they get caught in any kind of a crime, be it cocaine or child pornography or whatever else, they're not tried under the laws of Washington, D.C. They're in residency. In Washington, D.C., and the laws of their home country apply to them. That's why they put them on a plane and send them back to their home country. You could really take the term resident, and to be technically legally correct, you could say that the same thing is resident alien. Because any time you say you're a resident in a legal context, you're an alien because some other laws apply to you. So when you say you're a resident and they ask you that question of Louisiana or Michigan or California or wherever it is, and you say yes, thinking it means I live here, in the legal setting, you're saying, yes, the laws of Washington, D.C. apply to me.
Now, let me ask you a question. Will you repeat the definition that you started when you started speaking about this? You defined residence as you could receive a benefit or there might be a duty. Words to that effect. Do you want to do that one more time?
Sure. And that goes back to the key underpinning of the whole concept of jurisdiction, which is the whole thing that we're dealing with here. Listen, the key to the whole ball of wax of this whole mess up there and everywhere in the world, I've come to conclude, is this term jurisdiction. What gives you the right to impose and make and impose and enforce those laws on me? Okay.
And what's the answer to the question? What's the answer that gives them the right?
They've tricked you into becoming property, and they literally own you, all right?
Well,
and that's, you know, you've heard in these legal circles, Al, and I'm sure a number of people in the audience, this has been around for years, this benefits and duties thing. Whenever you're offered a benefit, you owe the duty. Well, benefit's just another word for privilege, and privilege is just another word for small r rights, as in civil rights.
Okay, now tell us about the duty. It said you were either entitled, the resident was either entitled to a benefit or had a duty. Isn't that true?
That's law. You see, that's law. You can.
No, here's where I'm going with this. If you have the first part of the definition I understood you to say you were entitled to receive a benefit. Am I right?
I don't like that word entitled.
Let's okay, but you regardless, you did reference or at least imply you could receive a benefit.
Yes.
Okay, and there's also a duty. And what that tells me, there can also be a duty. All right, now what that tells me is that the resident may be, that term may imply that he is a participant in a trust relationship. If you're entitled, if you receive a benefit, you are presumably a beneficiary. If you have a duty, you are presumably a fiduciary. And I know that the word that's used to describe the property that's owned by a trust is the res.
Yes, that's good.
And I'm wondering if res, and then the second part, I-D-E-N-T, does resident mean that you identify either as a fiduciary or as a beneficiary with a particular trust?
It wouldn't surprise me at all, and we talked
about it. I'm not saying it's true. Yeah, exactly. It's pure speculation. But where I'm going with this is if it's true that residents can receive either a beneficiary or be subject to a duty, I think it means that a resident is a person associated with a trust. And the question is, what trust are they allegedly associated with?
I don't know. I've never taken this, you know, to those.
No,
to
I understand. I understand. We're just speculating right now. We're just speculating right now.
Res means the thing.
Yeah, that's property of a trust.
Yeah, a thing. In the law, what we call property in the law is called a thing.
I follow.
The property is a right in and to control and use of the thing.
Yeah, but the trust always breaks that right up into an equitable title and a legal title. One party, the beneficiary, has equitable title or equitable right to use the res. The fiduciary has legal title, legal right to control, to own and control the res. And the point is, are you or are you not a member of the underlying trust? Now, I'm not saying this is true again. I'm just exploring a possibility.
Body politic, or as in Black Seventh, I think, puts it, if you go to look at jurisdiction, it says the state of the forum. You're a member of the forum.
That might be. When you asked earlier, you said something to the effect, by what right or authority do you deem that I'm subject to your law? Didn't you say that?
Yes, and you see, this goes back. Let's take a step back, and you can take.
Well, let me tell you what I think might what the answer might be.
Okay.
The presumption is, I sit there and I say, by what authority are you hassling me? And I think the answer to that question is by my authority. It is presumed that I voluntarily entered into this trust, perhaps as a fiduciary, perhaps as a beneficiary. But in either case, when I voluntarily entered in, I gave them permission to give me, you know, to hassle me, to harass me, to whatever, to put me in jail. The presumption.
You know, I've been thinking lately that this word that you've said twice now in the last couple of seconds is absolutely the key to understanding that, and that's presumption. How did they get the presumption?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It is presumed from your conduct. It's presumed from your conduct that you are a member of, it can be presumed from mere conduct that you are a party to a trust relationship.
Hey, let me tell you what I think's going on here, Al.
Pardon me?
Let me tell you what I think's going on here, and I'll reference it and tell you where I started this line of thought, was in the Georgia Code. I think we've talked about it on this show, in the section of the Official Code of Georgia Annotated, OCGA, all the traffic laws for uniform, it's in all 50 states, okay? Because that uniform word means they're all the same, all right? And in the middle of the section of residency, there's one sentence in this group of paragraphs, and it's right there by itself, and it says, resident is a rebuttable presumption.
Okay, I get now, that. But what does that also tell us?
What is this presumption, you see? And the only thing that I think that I've been able to come up with that that fits in all the little jagged pieces that I understand is this. In 33, when they declared bankruptcy, they already had 10 years of birth certificates on file because they started that back in the early 20s. So they had those people right there in what you're talking about, some sort of a contractual nexus. We can go into it and talk about it in more detail, but for here, let's just say that. They had those 10 years of birth certificates where people were now in a, at a position where they could move them in a new system as being property. In the feudal era, if your parents were voluntary serfs or involuntary, either way, and you were born when they were in that condition, you were born into that condition. But if they were voluntary serfs, you could always volunteer out just yep. like they could. And I think that's what's happening. And I think that's why they continue to ask you these little questions. Are you a resident? This is just like in sales. If you're doing a sales presentation, they have a bunch of things called tie downs. And those are little questions that you know are, they're going to answer yes to. And you lead them up to the big question when you say you're going to buy this. And then they're conditioned to answering yes. And I think that these little tie-down questions, I call them, are like Gulliver's Travels. I think they're just continuing to affirm, are you a voluntary serf? Yep, that's me. Are you a voluntary? Yep. Are you a citizen of the United States? Yep. Are you a resident? Yep. Boom, boom, boom. Until you make a personal declaration all the way conforming with the law of nations from Vattel all the way forward, and you make that properly and execute it properly and file it properly, and I think you're out of the system. I think this is the trap door that they had to leave in to make the thing pass constitutional muster.
It has to be voluntary. It has to be voluntary. It can't be mandatory, but they've set up these presumptions, and they call them rebuttable presumptions. And it means I could presume certain things as a judge. I'm entitled to presume something, and these presumptions, these silent presumptions, will control unless and until the defendant has brains enough to rebut the presumption. And what that means, he must expressly say, heck no, I am not a resident, I am not a United States citizen, I'm a citizen, I'm one of the people of a state of the union, or whatever he wants to use for his defense. But the great danger is that these presumptions can be silent. The judge doesn't have to inform you of the presumption. You are supposed to have brains enough to know that they're presuming you to be a resident, and you are supposed to have brains enough to therefore stand up and rebut that presumption by saying, no, I'm not. And all of this happens, the average man has no clue. This stuff is... It's like magic, right?
It is
it's
magic.
Like,
it's Freemason
well, it is
magic.
Because it's
Satan
done without
magic.
It's without it's done. All of a sudden, you find yourself caught in a cage, and you don't even understand why. And it's because the judge is entitled, excuse me, to use certain presumptions, but he doesn't have to tell you what they are. You're supposed to know. You're supposed to know what's going on in the judge's head. And if you don't know and don't expressly refute the presumptions that have, they're not on the record. They're only in the judge's mind. If you don't expressly refute those, guess what? You're going to jail, or you're paying a fine, or you're losing your kids, or God knows what's going to happen to you. On the other hand, if you know the presumptions, and you expressly stand up, number one, I'm not a resident, number two, I'm not a citizen of the United States, number three, yada yada, fill in the blanks. Now they have a problem. Defeat the presumptions, and they have a problem, particularly if you can discern what those presumptions are and challenge them long before you ever get to court.
See, here's the catch 22 therein, and why they've gone to such lengths to hide and obfuscate this is there's only two options. It's just like I said, you either get your laws from God or you get your laws from man, okay? So there's only two options. So don't go in and tell them what you are, because then that just gives them a point to argue. Go in and prove to them what you're not and let them figure out what you are. There's only one other option. This is catch 22. This is checkmate, Satan.
I won't necessarily agree there's only one other option in terms of the law. I read the law like this. Number one, you have God's law. God's law says that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, and not God's law, but the Declaration of Independence. It relies on God. There's God's law, which creates the sovereigns. The sovereigns create the Constitution. That's the law of the people, the law of the sovereigns, and then the government creates the third class of law, which is the statutes that are the laws of government. Government says, you got to obey our statutes. We're telling government, no, you got to obey our Constitution. God's telling us, yo, you got to. We have to obey God's law. Nobody wants to obey someone else's law, but we all want someone to obey our law.
Constitutional rights.
Well, here's one of the things, one of the laws we're going to have to obey is the law of commercial interruption, which begins now. I'll be back with Roger Sales in just a moment. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Countries have denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a Ku band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk here with Roger Sales on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Gold is down at an extremely low price. You ought to give Melody a call, 1-800-375-4188. If you're looking for gold, now's the time to buy. 1-800-375-4188. Roger and I are talking about, among other things, about presumptions, and here is some law on presumptions found at Section 40, Subsection 120, Rule 308. This is from Oregon, according to Frank, our producer. He supplied this, and it says presumptions in civil proceedings, Rule 308. In civil actions and proceedings, a presumption imposes on the party against whom it is directed the burden of proving that the non-existence of the presumed fact is more probable than its existence. All right? Does that make sense, Roger? Are you able to follow what I'm reading there, or shall I read it again?
No, it's a softball, man.
All right, go ahead.
All you got to do is make your declaration. I mean, they're telling you that we're going to say it's this unless you tell us and prove to us otherwise.
Yeah, but it does say a presumption imposes on the party against whom it is directed the burden of proving that the non-existence of a presumed fact. If I presume Roger is from Mars, it's up to Roger to defeat that presumption. He has to expressly stand up and say, I deny under oath that I'm from Mars. Words to that effect. But how does Roger know if I presume he's from Mars? I'm putting this burden on him. The presumption is strictly in my mind. Now, how is Roger supposed to deduce that I think he's a Martian? How does he deduce that and therefore stand up? You've got to be very astute. You've got to be well-informed. You've got to follow programs like this, publications like Roger's book, in order to anticipate these presumptions. And then you've got to be able to sit up and say, nope, 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 doesn't apply to me. Nope, that's not me. I'm not a Martian.
You know,
now what?
It goes back. I've used it so many times. I think it's one of the most brilliant quotes out of any of these civil Supreme Court cases is the quote from Judge Learned Hand. It's taken somewhat out of context, but this certainly was his meaning. And he said, to claim one's rights, one has to be a belligerent claimant.
Yeah.
Now, how can you belligerently claim your rights against these tyrants in mask if you don't know these concepts and basics and have a thorough working understanding of them? Because the settings, and Al and I can both testify to this, as I'm sure a number of you can that are listening, you get in a confrontation with one of these goons, and it's real hard to keep all your little marbles in a pile. If you know what I mean.
Well,
It's intimidating. It's like going to court. It is intimidating, okay?
It's like stepping into a boxing ring. People walk in, and you think you're going to walk into an arena where justice is done. And what you're going into is mixed martial arts. That's what's really going on. You get in there, you're going to explain things.
Al, you know the scene in, remember Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid? Remember that movie?
Sure.
Remember when they got out of the U.S. and they were down here in Bolivia and they were going to get in a fight and the guy was standing there, that big guy over Paul Newman, and Paul Newman said, you know, first we need to go over the rules. And the guy goes, rules? What rules? And he kicks him right in the crotch. Remember that?
No, I can't say that I do right off the top of my head.
The rules, okay? I know people in the audience remember that because every man that ever saw that groaned.
Well, I'll tell you what rings my bell is if you talk about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Given that I think I'm a year younger than you are, if we have to go out under the headline of the Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, you got to be Butch. And I get to be the kid.
Well, I got a leg up on you because Bolivia's real close to me now.
All right, what do we have here?
I wanted to drop back a step from this last segment when we were talking about this benefits thing, because this is even a much broader understanding here, because benefits, as we said, are just another word for rights, and as in civil rights, privileges.
You have a right to benefits. Benefits are associated with rights, but I wouldn't say that the term, as a beneficiary, you have a right to the benefits.
If you're presumed
you're a beneficiary.
In the U.S., if you got benefits coming, you got civil rights and not God-given natural rights is my point. I'm trying to get to something here and
they
not get too embroiled in the minutia. But what I wanted to say was, you know, the formula for all law, there's about seven or eight jurisdictions, probably a lot more, seven or eight, you know, that are notable. And the formula is R plus D equals R. And what that stands for is rights plus duties equal remedies. You're given a right. If someone infringes on that right or you do not uphold the correlated duty, then there's a remedy. And that formula fits every jurisdictional law in the world. And you can break it down to that basic a concept, because the law is rights, duties, and remedies.
I follow what you're saying, but sometimes what happens if you're in a position where you don't have rights, but you do have duties, and that would apply to a fiduciary. Or you do have rights, but you don't have duties, which would apply to a beneficiary. Now we've got R equals, what does R equal if you only have rights? Does it mean relief?
You know, whatever area is covered by those circumstances is covered with rules that handle that jurisdiction. I'm talking about the overall general conceptual understanding here for people, because this is important, man. If you can break things down this simply, then you can start thinking through some of these things. And what you were talking about a minute ago when we first started this segment of, you know, if you want to become aware of this stuff and have a handle on it to where you can be a belligerent claimant, I know it's terrible, but you're going to have to study, and you're going to have to start thinking again.
Yeah, because that's exactly right.
Because this boils down, as we've said so many times on this very show, this whole ball of wax boils down to personal responsibility. I don't want the damn agents of government taking care of me. I want to be responsible for myself, because that way I learn, and I do things right, because if I screw up, there's consequences.
Yep. That's exactly right. If you are personally responsible, you know, I used to do roofing years ago, and my competitors would give a 90-day guarantee on their work. I gave a one-year guarantee, and I had a great advantage, because you can repair roof leaks with a stick of bubble gum. It'll last, if you know what you're doing, it'll last for 90 days. It's not a challenge. But if you're going to extend your guarantee out to a year, and there was no requirement for it, I did that, all right? As a competitive device, but it teaches you your business. If your repairs have to stand up for a year, they have so much more exposure to the weather that people call you back and they say, wait, it's still leaking. And you go back the second time. And then you, at your own expense, and it forces you to learn whatever it was you overlooked or whatever it is you failed to do the first time you were there. And I guarantee you, the guarantee, your extended guarantee, teaches you your business. And the more responsibility you assume, the more personal responsibility you assume, the more you learn. When you're insulated from personal responsibility, you don't have an obligation to learn anything. You can be fat, dumb, and happy.
That's my problem with insurance. It's a limited liability, you know.
Yeah.
I loved what I heard George Gordon say one time on the air, and I was listening to him, and he said, I hate insurance. I don't want limited liability. I want personal liability. And if I damage you and I can't pay you, drill a hole in my ear, and I'll be your slave.
Yeah. You know, and how does this relate to the Bible?
Totally.
Well, here's my point. We've got the government coming in and giving us limited liability by means of insurance. We've got the government giving us limited liability by means of Social Security. You don't have to provide for your own retirement. We've got the government telling us that we don't have to be personally responsible, and in a sense, it parallels what Satan told Eve back in the day when he said, "Surely you will not die." He said, you don't have to be responsible for this. That isn't going to happen to you. God is saying, if the Bible is true, he is essentially saying that if you screw up enough in this life, you can spend your eternity in a lake of fire. That is unlimited personal liability. There is... Understand, he's saying you've got unlimited personal liability, and the government said, no, no, stick with us, and you can have limited personal liability. I don't know if I'm making this very clear, but what point I'm trying to get across is that the government is preaching a different faith to us with their promises of limited liability than we find in the Bible. And I don't think it's an accident.
all of this, no accident, brother. After all this reading over all these years, I remember I got a hold of a book one time. It, unfortunately, it wasn't a big published book, but it was a pamphlet that somebody had written, and I don't remember where I got it. I made copies of it, and they've just been lost along the line, but I remember the text and the gist of it. And it was written by an attorney in St. Louis in the 40s after the New Deal. And this whole paper, and it was extremely documented, was how Roosevelt had come in and broken down the entire social safety net that was in place, that had been built and in place since the start of the country, and broke it down in the 30s. He took away all of the charitable things that were handled
through
exactly churches,
right,
and all that stuff the way it used to be, where it was people helping people, and they stuck the government in place. So now you're sucking on the government it again, all right?
Oh, not only that. Here's the problem. When you had the charities local, all right, they handed out the money that had to be handed out to the poor. I don't say that the poor were well taken care of. I'm not making that argument, but I am saying that the money stayed in the local community. But there have been studies by the Rand Corporation back in the 90s that indicate that for every $100 that we send to government, when government says, we will take responsibility for the women, the children, the poor, whoever's got a problem, don't worry, we're the government, we can handle these things. So for every $100 we send to the government, how much do you think gets to the poor or the women or the children?
Ten cents.
Their first study indicated something like 20 cents on the dollar. Later came back and it was 15 cents on the dollar. So you're in the ballpark. That's why government's taken over the charity, so it can rob you. They're not delivering the money. You would be better off if you gave, instead of sending $100 to the government, give $50 to your church and let the church disperse $50 to the needy. And in the end, the needy would get more money, and you wouldn't pay as much money, and the only people who wouldn't be making as much money would be the government.
Those middlemen, man. It's the middlemen. You know, Bortz used to tell a story when they passed Social Security. I know we're getting close to end of time. I'll try and rush this. When they passed the Social Security legislation, initially there was a loophole in there, and municipalities and cities could exit out and do their own system. And there was only one place in the country that did it. It was down around Beaumont, Corpus Christi. And the people that are in that system down there, their own little pension plan, the lowest municipal worker for the city gets $120,000 a year.
After
the
he retires.
Paid one.
After he retires.
Absolutely, and the Social Security average for that would be about $700 a month.
Yeah,
you
I
compute
understand.
Compute that times 12, and there's your 90% scraping right out the middle up there in the district criminals.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. This government is nothing but a giant racket. All right? You got the Bloods, the Crips, and the government. Three gangs. And they're all up to the same thing. Huh? The only difference is whether you're wearing a red bandana, a blue bandana, or if you're wearing a badge.
Or a red, white, and blue.
Yeah, right.
Hey, Al, I wanted to also mention something while we're in. I know we're close again. Did you know
45
that the
seconds.
Concept? Did you know that the concept of insurance and the concept of central banking were conceived in the same city, Amsterdam, in the same year? And you don't think
someone
these two are thick?
It must have been thick. The diabolical convention or annual convention or something. I'm not sure.
You could get into a lot of background. It was after a lot of those guys were kicked out of Spain, and they all went up there to Holland because they were friendly to them at that point, and they all got congregated, and that's when the Dutch were such strong traders around the world and had such a mercantile little system. And I guess all of this kind of came up in that Petri dish. Anyway, man, it's always been great to be with you in the audience, and this has been a particularly good show that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I have too. We stumbled into some new information that's new to both of us, I think, at least new speculation. But right now, Roger, we're out of time. So I want to thank you for being on the program. I want to thank all you folks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Melody. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Roger, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.
All day to pay the bills I have to the past.